So welcome to the first day of our October Kho Sesshin here at the Home of Zen Monastery. We are in the second Sesshin that we're doing for the autumn Kesai, the 90-day training period. It's a very intense period in the training year at Rinzai Monasteries. They're also in Sesshin at Sogenji, our parent monastery in Okayama, Japan, right now. So once again, we have this shared connection between Japan and here, between the two Sogenjis. This is Tohoma-san Sogenji Monastery on Whidbey Island. So as you sit, you can just root yourself in that connection of all the other bodies rooted into the ground, all practicing, all dipping into the one mind. During this training period, we're of course reading from Tori Inji, his discourse on the inexhaustible lamp of the Zen school. Tori Inji was a Dharma heir of Hakuin, and he wrote this book while suffering from tuberculosis, fearing he's going to die and not contribute to the spreading, the passing on of that inexhaustible lamp. And so he wrote this text, and then he recovered from his illness, and years later, Hakuin persuaded him to publish it. We've been reading this since August. And so we are on, we're in the first chapter, which is called Concerning the Lineage of Our School. And we are in the ninth section on page 48. We'll continue on from here. After the Hōtō cycle, the Dharma gate of the Prajna Paramita cycle was taught. These teachings sift the mixture of higher and lower of the two vehicles and the three baskets, and from it select the Dharma of emptiness. This is also called to pull out the small emptiness and restore it to the full emptiness. Or again, to smash up the temporary emptiness and arrive at the true emptiness. After having taught these for many years, the time had ripened to expound the round and sudden Dharma gate of reality. Dirty water poured over one's head. The three vehicles and five natures alike are all the one Buddha vehicle. Independent of the amount of wisdom, having faith in the one Buddha vehicle makes possible entry into it. For this, we have the guidance of the old records. This is Buddha, is not taught immediately. Important is to just practice faithfully, as pointed out in the Sutra of the Wonderful Law, and to express the proof of attainment as taught in the Nirvana Sutra. So this first section concerning the lineage of our school begins with Shakyamuni and continues down to the various ways that the teachings have been presented. And in this, Tore and likewise Master Daibi in his upcoming commentary, they reflect the mythological teachings of the Buddha in that they are presenting the entire body of the sutras as if this was taught in the Buddha's career, right? So in the beginning, he taught the Flower Garland Sutra, and then he taught the path of the Shravaka and the path of the Pratitya Buddha and the various teachings of the lesser vehicle. And then when people weren't practicing diligently enough, they did what they called here the Hōtō cycle, which is this critical cycle, exhorting people to more greater practice. And then after that, the Prajnaparamita literature, and then the Lotus Sutra and the Nirvana Sutra, right? So of course the actual production of those texts was over the course of something like 1,000 years or 700 years or something, and not really attributed to the Buddha. But it is illustrative of this kind of development of the path that an individual in Indian Buddhism could take, right? You begin with the Four Noble Truths, right? Life is suffering, and here's the path to get out of that, the chain of dependent origination. And then, you know, at that point, right, the Hōtō cycle came next. So they, you know, if you're slacking off, not diligent in your practice, maybe you've seen into the impermanence of things and feel satisfied with that. And so they scolds you into greater practice, right? And so then once you kind of get over that, then you're at this point now where you can like, well, in these early teachings, we had this kind of one concept of emptiness, right? Which would be the root concept of emptiness, which is that nothing has any permanent core, right? So that's the what they call the small emptiness, but that's the basis from which it all arises, right? And that's what you see in the chain of dependent origination, right? The impermanence of all things is when you really investigate anything, a thought or any object, you see that it only comes into being because of causes and conditions, because of circumstances. And that when you pare things down to the essence, there is nothing there. There is no thing that survives permanently. So that's the small notion of emptiness. So at that point, you're ready for that, right? You've gone through that, and you've been scolded into like more diligent practice, and now you are ready to understand like the true nature of emptiness, right? And that's the Prajnaparamita literature, right? So Prajna is, of course, the sixth paramita. You know, you can look at the paramitas as all having equal weight, but you could also look at the paramitas as all flowing towards, you know, steps to prajna, right, which we translate as wisdom. But as I've mentioned a few times, what it really is more like is like this true understanding of the emptiness of all things, right? And that is true wisdom, right? So wisdom kind of works, but there has to be an asterisk there. And in Dibi's comments and others in this, they'll often say prajna wisdom, right? So if prajna actually meant wisdom, it would be a wisdom, which could maybe be a sort of meta wisdom, perhaps. But really what they're trying to get at is that prajna, like you could say the effect on the small person, right? Our relative person is wisdom because we understand how things truly are. And that is a form of wisdom, but not quite how we tend to use that in the West. Like it might be an understanding of how things truly are, but in sort of the relative world, I would say, or maybe both, right? Real wisdom is maybe considered to be the understanding of how things have come to be as well as how they truly are. And so then, right, so then once you've really kind of grappled and embodied the reality of things, right? Then it says you're ready for the round and sudden Dharma gate of reality, right? That's what how they describe these last later sutras, the Lotus Sutra and the Nirvana Sutra. And I have personally never heard of this round, the round gate. So I'm not sure what that's actually translating in this book, where some of the translations are a little idiosyncratic. But suffice it to say, as they noted earlier in this text, that in the Buddha's teaching, the only thing that is in all the teachings, right, revolves around the person, right, and the nature of things and metaphor, right. And the Lotus Sutra is all metaphors, right? The Lotus Sutra is really large, and it just contains all these sort of different ways of looking at it, all sorts of circumstances, all different kinds of beings. This is where the metaphors, like the metaphor of the burning house are, and the metaphor of the teachings as the raft that takes you across the river and then is abandoned once you've gone to the other side, right? All these things are these metaphors, ways to present the teachings to different people in different places. So, and the Nirvana Sutra also has many metaphors, but is about the nature of Nirvana, whereas the Lotus Sutra is primarily, I think, these metaphors towards for people at different stages, right? So not exclusively concerned with nirvana. So anyway, so let's see what Dibe has to say about this. Well, anyway, actually, let me wrap that up. So my point is about this is that you could say that this is the course of one's whole practice career in the standard Indian Buddhist model, right? Is that you kind of begin in this self-oriented way, right? I want to get past my own suffering. That's the lesser path, right? And then you kind of get past that, and then you take on the Mahayana, right? That's the Prajnaparamita is the beginning of Mahayana, because to grasp that true emptiness, to be truly have wisdom, you have to be completely past the self, which means that orientation of awakening all things, awakening reality itself, an orientation, a vow that's beyond our abilities, right? The whole point of the great vow is that we can't possibly even imagine how to undertake the great vow. It's beyond human capabilities, right? And that's what makes it such a great vow, right? Because in this system, you could exist for, you know, kalpas, which is like 4 trillion years or something, right? You know, kalpa after kalpa have rebirths, and you can just keep on this task, right? So this is this unbelievable vow, and it's why for making that vow, your merit in the old system, you get merit for your good karma, karmic deeds, is infinite, right? You build up this body of merit that's infinite, the merit body. And that is the beginning of this true wisdom, right? Because it gets past the self, right? The idea of embodying true emptiness, which is embodying reality itself, or having no other sense beyond the entire body of reality, of which your relative body would be some portion, you know, minuscule portion of. And that is true wisdom, right? So that is the Mahayana. And of course, there's a lot of ramifications of that, which, you know, we often reductively look at as things like giving and compassion, right? There's these relative things, right? Not all of those actions in the Buddhist sense are relative, but, you know, we focus on the relative ones, the relative acts, these good deeds, right? That is very associated with the Mahayana, but is not really what the core of it is about, which is embodied in this Prajnaparamita literature. But this is the ramifications of it. As you become wise in that way, you naturally engage in acts of compassion and these good deeds, right? It's not in the sort of good works style of like, I am going to do all this stuff because this is, you know, this is the deal, right? These are good works, and that's, you know, either for merit in the old Buddhist system or in kind of Western religions, you know, because it's, you know, these are things that are expected of you, right? Or you're not sinning or whatever. So anyway, that is on the stage of your towards nirvana, right? Because this is the Indian system. On the stage towards nirvana, you have to let go of the last vestiges of the self, and then you become a selfless being. And when you're a selfless being, you are a positive force in the world, right? And so then I think you can see beyond that, the way that they're looking at this is that then in the Lotus Sutra is how you give the ultimate gift. And the ultimate gift in Indian Buddhism is to pass on the teachings, to train other people, to free other people, right? That is the great vow, is to free other people. And that's done for most people via the teachings. And so the Lotus Sutra has this huge collection of metaphors for that. And plus some of them are people who achieve awakening sort of bypassing that process, right? In the course of some of these metaphors in the Lotus and Nirvana Sutras. So this is why you can see this is such a key thing for that both the Chinese Tendai practice, which is oriented around the Lotus Sutra directly, and then the Chan practice is not as a key text, but it's an exemplar of the Chan orientation, which is the Prajnaparamita Mahayana orientation in direct sudden awakening. You know, which is why they call this the round and sudden gate, but like I said, I'm not sure what the round part means, but anyway. So that is how he is examining all of this, as if this was something that the Buddha taught in his, 50 years of teaching, this whole gigantic body of literature, but as a metaphor and as for our practice, it certainly holds up. So now let us read Dibe's comment. After the Hoto, the scolding and exhorting cycle, the Buddha taught the Dharma gate of the Prajnaparamita, the wisdom of emptiness. Within the period of the all-enlightened one's turning of the wheel of the Dharma, the Paramita teachings occupy the longest span, about 30 years. It is said that he taught at 4 places and to 16 assemblies. Here's a comment here that says, the 16 assemblies, 4 at each 4 places where the complete Prajnaparamita is said to have been expounded. And all of these, when he expounded, was, you know, there was hosts of gods and asuras and, various great bodhisattvas and so on and so forth, these huge, gigantic, mythical assemblies. Not only bodhisattvas of superior capabilities attended these, but those of the small capabilities of the 2 vehicles and 3 baskets also crowded in, so that holy and worldly, dragons and snakes were mixed together. Thus, a careful sorting is of paramount importance for grasping this Dharma of emptiness, and attaining to the true wisdom of emptiness depends on the care taken over this sorting. Hence, it is also said that if the scolding cycle is called a whip, the great wisdom gone beyond, the Prajnaparamita cycle, may be called a sorter. And what they mean by that, this sorting, is that they've sorted the teachings prior to the Prajnaparamita, right? And have taken this sort of subset of them and then expounded upon them, primarily the emptiness teachings of the earlier teachings. Ordinary people have their own ideas as to the meaning of empty. With our eyes, we cannot see the empty nothingness of emptiness, so we are prone to think of it as formless. But this is not what Buddhism calls emptiness. Buddhist emptiness is the true form, the true reality. It may also be called the true substance, Buddha nature, or true face. After all, truth is of itself empty. Though calling it the one emptiness, differences exist in it. There are 18 ways of emptiness listed in the great Prajnaparamita Sutra. So the Buddha, as a way of sorting it out, took those with genuine insight into little emptiness and made them go to the great emptiness, scolded those with only partial insight who lacked the genuine understanding and made them enter the full emptiness, or smashing up their temporary insight made them arrive at true emptiness. In such manner, leading from the low to the high, from the shallow to the profound, he got them finally to see into the truth of Prajna wisdom. When this had ripened and been achieved, after many years, the Buddha finally taught the Dharma gate of the round, sudden reality, the Sutra of the Wonderful Lotus of the Good Law, and the Mahayana Nirvana Sutra. So what it's noting here is that he's taking people wherever they are, and that's always the Buddha's way. He takes you where you are and provides the truth, you know, or the dharmas that are most useful to you at this time. So he took these people in various places, Shravastas, Pratika Buddhas, people who are slacking off, and gives them the point of it. Because in the Prajnaparamita, they know that he spent this long time doing it, and that's because the Prajnaparamita literature is really large. It's this vast collection of it. The entirety of it is like they all have these names, like the Prajnaparamita in 30,000 lines, right? So one of them, or maybe 50,000 lines, is the longest one, and that's the Maha Prajnaparamita, the great Prajnaparamita. And then there's the Prajnaparamita in 30,000 lines, and the Prajnaparamita in 20,000 lines, and the Prajnaparamita in 5,000 lines, right? The Diamond Sutra is the Prajnaparamita in, I think, 700 lines, something like that, right? So that's its actual name. And so there's this huge body of it, and it is primarily, if you look at it, it's bodhisattvas questioning the Buddhas about something, and the Buddha telling them that they're not real, right? Or a bodhisattva, somebody's questioning like Manjushri, and he's saying, they'll be like, well, what about this concept or this notion or this real thing? And he'd be like, yeah, well, he'd work them to a point where they see its emptiness. And there's just hundreds and hundreds of these examples. And that's what he means, like looking at this from all these different angles so you can present it to wherever somebody is at and see the emptiness of things. You know, and as in Red Pine's commentary on the Diamond Sutra, he notes that that's the entire body of the Prajnaparamita literature, and he goes into more description of all the different ones. If you're curious, that is a good resource for that. But anyway, he notes that in the Diamond Sutra, after noting that everything basically you could possibly ask about is empty, he being the Buddha, mythologically says what is real in the Diamond Sutra, and what is real is this emptiness as the true form, the true reality, as Daibi says. And that is all that is real. Referring to these last sutras the Buddha preached, Master Torai utters, "Dirty water poured over one's head." In this, Master Torai shows his own strength. The late Master Ryoko commented on this, "It is endorsing the understanding that the Buddha did not preach a single word. This is something people must learn to appreciate." And of course, during the September Sesshin, I talked about this quite a bit, about how words are always can cause more harm than good, right? So anytime you're teaching these sort of things, expounding these, there's always the risk that you're making things worse for somebody, right? And so, thus, dirty water. With regard to the mixed assemblies of the Lotus and Nirvana Sutras, these are the root energies of the three vehicles, Shravaka, Pratika Buddha, and Bodhisattva. The five natures are classified as of the Shravaka, the Pratika Buddha, Bodhisattva, those of indeterminate nature, and those who have no Buddha nature. All, however, are inherently supplied with the faculty of becoming Buddha in the future, and so all in the end return to the one Buddha vehicle. Having faith in this, faith in the great sea of the Buddha Dharma, they are able to enter it. For this entering, the degree of wisdom at the disposal of the individual is irrelevant. To begin with, the insight that this is Buddha, this very body is the Buddha, is not necessary. There are relevant parts in the Lotus Sutra where the Buddha addresses disciples and bodhisattvas and prophecies that in the world, as yet far ahead in the future, they would all become Buddha. In the Flower Garland and Nirvana Sutras, the Buddha expounds the one way of faithful practice and of entering authentication of attainment, and clearly states that students who single-mindedly follow his holy teachings are cultivating realization. A few practical examples of this may be useful. In the Flower Garland Sutra, there is the story of Zenzai Doshi, which means youth of good fortune. The youth first put his heart under the guidance of the Bodhisattva Manjushri. In this case, it probably should be mind. The youth first put his mind under the guidance of the Bodhisattva Manjushri. Then he went on a pilgrimage to the south, trained under 53 good teachers, and finally arrived at Maitreya Bodhisattva's abode, where he passed the authentication and was accepted. The Nirvana Sutra relates the story of Kakaku Toji, the butcher. Generally, such livelihood is far from the way of the Buddha. Toji, however, through plying this brutal trade, once accidentally heard the enlightened teachings of Sariputra, a disciple of the Buddha. At that, he at once threw away his butcher's knife, dripping with blood, and exclaimed, "I too am one of the thousand Buddhas," entered the authentication of attainment, and became awakened. So you can see that these texts are all these examples. As he noted, it is these metaphors and stories for these people. And he notes that the insight that this is Buddha, this very body is Buddha, which is one of the things that is in the Lotus and Nirvana Sutras, right? And this is, of course, you know, the Chan perspective. This is kind of what we're getting to at some point, right? Where we can say that all things have Buddha nature, right? That everything is the Buddha, and things that say everything is already, there's nothing to be awakened from, right? That when you do see past the little self that filters reality and see things, our own experiences directly, nothing has changed. You realize nothing has changed then. So that is a later teaching, basically, is the way that they're putting it. right? And when we think of this more in historical terms, develop over a long time, all of these things are are an actual development of the course that the previous teachings had taken, right? Because there's these huge amounts of commentaries written on all these, and they have this huge amount, there's a huge amount of time and a huge amount of practitioners taken involved in it, and they can just kind of see how things work. And when you have a lot of thinkers, people thinking about this, or even people looking directly in their own insight, you get nuanced views, and you get like a variety of views. And then I think you see your limitations. I've mentioned before that the Mahayana can be seen as more like a reformation movement of where Buddhism was at that time, right? Considering that before that was this Hōtō cycle, which was this critical period, where clearly was probably a sort of a low point in the history of Indian Buddhism. I am not actually up enough on that side of the history to really say, so it's somewhat speculative, but it is how it always goes. Religions and all their different forms and practices and all their different forms always have these points when they are corrupted in some way, and then these revivals. And it's just this constant cycle. Especially you see this in Chan and even more so in Zen in Japan, where it's just this constant period where there's a great teacher appears, a Bankei or a Basui or a Hakuin, and there'll be these huge things. There'll be throngs of thousands and thousands of people coming to hear them speak, and then there'll be a couple generations, and then they'll be in decline, right? So there's a constant cycle, and you see it in every Western religions, everything, constant cycle of decline and renewal, right? And usually what gets it out of the decline, the renewal, is a new approach, right? This could be presented by a charismatic, popular teacher, right? Sometimes it can be, a reformation to taking you back to first principles, simplify things, a fundamentalist view. I mean, there's these different ways that renewals occur, but it's just a standard historical model. When you look at this, it just repeats itself over and over again. So who knows exactly? I mean, I don't at least don't know exactly what precipitated the beginning of the Mahayana, but I do think it was that self-oriented aspect of the practice to that point. And a lot of the ascetic practices in India in that way were just a person going off and doing this thing for their own reason, their own benefit in some way. So the Mahayana can be seen as that. And then there was these great thinkers. So Nagarjuna, for instance, who developed the middle way, the Madhyamaka. It's incredibly subtle and deep philosophical things. And there's this whole philosophical commentary, right, that's beyond like what you see in your direct experience. And from that, then practices are pulled out of and approaches from that. And this happens many, many times in India. So anyway, this is on to section 10. However, it is extremely difficult to penetrate deeply into the Buddha Dharma. The Buddha possessed tenfold strength, a tamer of the passions of man. His disciples were wise and holy monks. How then could the Dharma gate be shallow or easily accessible? Also, teaching mixed assemblies needs discernment and finely graduated nuances. Each one individually has to see fully into his true nature. And that means to give himself patiently to the Dharma and to abide in it without flagging. Even when all this has been accomplished, there is still the further step of advanced practice. This point here, the teaching of mixed assemblies needs discernment and finely graduated nuances. This is, I think, a very important point that I've actually personally thought about, not in these specific terms, but I've thought about for a long time. Whenever you take part in any event at a temple or a monastery, a sesshin or a practice day or whatever that you do, a workshop even, it has to be presented in such a way, right? The structure and the orientation of it is in such a way that people can come at nearly all levels.
You typically can't be like a go from zero practice to sesshin, but I'm sure that has happened. And you think in the talks that are given, they always have to be able to be at least understandable by all the minds in the audience to some degree, right? To some degree. I did a lot of different music workshops, different instruments over the years. And one thing I always felt by that was that they were almost always beginner oriented. And then sometimes they were advanced student oriented. I was doing a lot of Irish music, and it was like you either were getting this absolute beginner material, or you were expected to be able to just sit down and just take everything on by ear and just jam along, basically. And the intermediate things were very rarely offered, right? Once you hit the intermediate phase yourself, the beginning stuff was a little, didn't offer you very much, and you weren't quite ready for the advanced stuff. But the intermediate things were very hard to do. And in these music classes, of course, they very explicitly targeted it, right? It would be say up front, this is a beginner thing, we'll hand out sheet music, we'll go through this, And occasionally you would have an intermediate class, and it was always like a welcome event. Because, as a student of anything, right, any topic, the intermediate levels where you spend most of the time, right? If you practice enough and study enough and spend enough years at it, you'll get past the beginning stage for sure. But then it's a long time, whatever it is. The 10,000 hours has been somewhat discredited, but it's probably something like that, maybe longer, right? So that's just a long time. So in between that, 10,000 hours was true, the first 1,000 hours might be the beginning stage, and then the last 1,000 hours, you might be a pretty advanced person. So then you're spending 8,000 hours as an intermediate person. So when you're trying to teach, whether it's a musical instrument or history or, woodworking, anything from a physical activity to a purely intellectual activity, you have to target to the audience, right? And in presenting something, these practices and the teachings around them, you can't really set the understanding level of the audience, like where they're at. Both at an intellectual level, right? Like I probably couldn't sit here and be reading in pure Sanskrit the whole time. First, because I'm not capable of it, but who in the audience, what percentage would be able to handle that, be able to take that, or be at that level, right? So that's kind of the intellectual level, but primarily what, of course, we're interested in Zen and Chan practice is presenting material that reaches people where they are at in their spiritual practice and can help them see deeper, right, beyond wherever they're at, right? At the very least, as I've quoted Roshi Bodhin many times, saying you don't want to present something that adds to the attachments of people when you're giving these talks. And so, in these historical, mythological talks, there's always, and like 1,000 people were awakened after the Buddha gave this talk. And you actually see this into the, among the Chan and Zen masters, right? There's plenty of things where Hakuin would give a talk and, 200 people were awakened during that talk. There's a bunch of that in the Platform Sutra at the end of it after Hui Ning gives these talks. Like everybody in the audience was, saw into their true nature. And, I think one can have a justifiable skepticism of that, but, because the idea is, there's no one singular phrase or magic words that can awaken anybody, have them see into their true nature, but there might be a phrase and word that's spoken at this at a certain time that reaches somebody right where they're at. So to do that for everybody in the audience, right, this is what they attribute to these speakers to show that to try to get at the power of this teaching, right? So look, right here, there's a
There's a note on this page of the 10 powers of the Buddha, and let me read these. These are the 10 powers that's attributed to the Buddha. He knows the right and wrong of every condition. He knows the past, present, and future karma of every being. He knows all stages of meditative insight, liberation, and samadhi. He knows the powers and faculties of all beings. He knows the desires or moral directions of all beings. He knows the actual disposition of every being. He knows the direction and consequences of all laws. By that, it means karmic laws, or actions even. He knows all former existences through countless kalpas. He knows how the good and bad of all living beings arises and ceases. Having himself exhausted the outflows, he knows the deliverance of the mind from the outflows. So that's pretty incredible powers, right? Because just once you talk about all beings, and it's using all beings, right, which is not just all humans even, right? You know, that's just a lot to hold in. This is usually more, I mean, it's put this way. This is definitely how it's put, but usually it's more put in a more nuanced way, that with the Dharma eye, right? The Dharma eye allows you to look at a given being and see where they're at, right? So it's not like some sort of unbelievable God-like powers of having every single being's karmic, you know, potential and issues and exactly the perfect thing that they need at that moment known at, you know, for everyone all at once. It's anyone that you're in encounter with, you are able to ascertain that, right? And on an individual level, that is, I think, relatively believable in a certain way. Not that you necessarily know the exact, you know, I mean, this is speculating about bodhisattvas at this level, but, you know, the bodhisattvas at this level are pretty mythological, so everyone is speculating, right? But once you've had any sort of insight, you begin to have this ability to tell that other people have had insight, right? That's very common, right? I mean, I can speak from that, from my own experience. You can kind of tell. You can even tell when you read something, whether that person is speaking from a genuine insight or kind of a more intellectual angle. And so I could see that you could then, you know, so this is now more speculative for me, not purely from experience, but sometimes in my experience, you can kind of see where someone is at and kind of what's they're blocking them. Right, what their current attachments are. You can see their attachments. So in theory, right, you could then say like, all right, this is their attachment, this is something that'll help get them past it, right? And you may even be clear enough on what their attachments are to be like, well, no single phrase is gonna get them past that. It's gonna require, you know, a lot of sitting and a bunch of these, you know, X, Y, and Z has to happen type of thing, right? But I mean, I could see that, right? That is, you become, you could think like increasingly empathetic on a sort of true nature level, from experience and true nature, and being open, you become increasingly open, right? And so just in a lot of these stories, that just becomes very blown out in this. But my point of this is that when you're addressing an assembly, attributing to the Buddha the power that he knows exactly what the entire body needs to hear at that moment to awaken means that over the course of his discourse, see, all those things could be said and everyone could awaken, right? So this is, you know, a way of illustrating that ability, right? Even if, you know, in reality it works in this more one-to-one, you know, smaller level. But discounting people with the Buddha's powers, real or imagined, when you're addressing an assembly, you can't know that, right? Like I said, maybe on an individual level, you can get some insight into where they're at and what they need to hear. But when you're not talking to anyone, they're just people sitting there, you have no idea, right? Now, a teacher who's worked with people, you know, when Roshi is doing a teisho here, you know, he's familiar with almost everyone at a pretty intimate level from Sanzen. And you know, in theory, you could work it in that way, right? Through experience, but it is, once again, accumulation of those individual encounters. So what it seems to me is what you typically get, though, is you keep things much more at this level where it's,
not going to add to these attachments of people in general. You know, you never know with any individual, but in the main, it won't, right? Exhortations to practice, the core insights, the core things there. You're not saying a specific thing that might awaken one person in the audience, you know, because you don't necessarily know what that is. So let's, there'll be some examples of this in Daibi's comment. Let's move on to that. Though the classification of the Buddha's teaching from the Flower Garland Sutra to the Lotus Sutra was discussed above, this is not even scratching the surface. It only serves to illustrate that the Buddha Dharma is truly vast and boundless, and the holy teachings are truly deep and profound. No wonder the all-enlightened one's strength as a teacher was tenfold, a veritable tamer of the human passions. His disciples, as they took their ordered places in the assemblies, were truly wise and holy monks. Therefore, his teachings are certainly not to be taken in a superficial sense. The Buddha's 10 powers are listed in the great Prajnaparamita Sutra. Tamer of the human passions is one of the 10 appellations of the Buddha. With reference to this term, an old master said, "The Buddha is a skillful tamer of the passions, making all go the way of practice so that they may be liberated." A superb trainer can completely and freely handle a horse and make it do what is required. Just so the Buddha taught his disciples at the assemblies. This old master, he quotes, "The Buddha is a skillful tamer of the passions, making all go in the way of practice so that they may be liberated." That, I think, is a more accurate description of what goes on in most Taisho or Dharma talks, is the exhortation to practice, right? And if you can think back to Taishos where you've heard that, it'll often be from multiple different angles, right? And that just kind of covers the bases, right? Where most people are at, right? So it can be something like the Hoto cycle where people are scolded into it. You know, you often get a time is short, you know, Sesshin is a rare opportunity to go deep into yourself. And not everyone in this world, very few people in this world, can have the luxury to do that. So put this time to good use. Take full advantage of that. And that's always good advice, right? I mean, beyond this meta level of like, what are we trying to do in a discourse, right? Having these abilities, that is, you know, the approach you should be taking this weekend. But that is just an example of how the Buddha, as a skillful tamer of the passions, exhorts people to practice in different ways. Daibi continues, "He started with the Agama teachings as a skillful means in accordance with his listener's root energy. When he, this part here is going to be this thing where I said earlier how he kind of lays this out as the sort of course of your whole practice, this 700 years of developed teachings. So this is it. This is where Daibi is going to do that. And the Agama teachings, just to remind people, are the lesser vehicle of the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Chain of Dependent Origination. He started with the Agama teachings as a skillful means in accordance with his listeners' root energy. When he had made them go so far, he next scolded them to make them turn their heads towards the great vehicle. When they had progressed that far, in the period of the wisdom teachings, he made them see into the differentiations, the real and seeming, and into the true void of the Mahayana." And this part here, the differentiations and the true void of the Mahayana, that's more or less the Madhyamaka teachings. "Finally, at the end of the standpoint of the round and sudden teachings, the Dharma gate of the true state and origin, he caused all to return to and abide in the one Buddha vehicle. Just this was his skill. The strength and wisdom of his skill means were truly profound." And this idea of the one Buddha vehicle is like looking at the entire body of the teachings, right? Where you look at it as kind of I've been saying here, which is this huge body of skillful means, this huge body of metaphors, all these places that work at different stages, right? You know, at each stage, he kind of presents it as almost this is the whole teaching. Like, this is all you need. Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, that'll get you all the way, right? And then later on, it's kind of like, well, yeah, you should also, you know, look into the true nature of emptiness. All right, so the one Buddha vehicle, right? So there's the lesser and the great vehicle, and then the one vehicle is the whole thing.
Thus, his disciples were able to cut through the afflicting passions, the kleshas, and to see into their true nature, which has no outflows. Each one himself, individually trained, with faith in mind and without flagging, patiently giving himself to the Dharma, which means particularly to stay with the Dharma, which cannot be attained. And they make a note here that says, what I give myself to, I cannot attain. And this, of course, is the classic Chan truth, that there's nothing to attain, right? As I talked about earlier. But even if all this has been achieved and the practice of the Buddha's path has been completed, there is still the one extra point of advanced practice, which is truly the living spirit, the very marrow of the Buddha Dharma. This can never be reached by words or explanations, nor can it be understood by discrimination or even by wisdom. Just this constitutes the special transmission outside the scriptures. And of course, that is what Chan always made its claim on, as being the special transmission outside the scriptures. And I'll read one last bit here from Tori. Late in his teaching career, the Buddha once held up a flower before a large assembly on the Vulture Peak. None of the vast crowd understood. Only Mahakashapa's face broke into a smile. The Buddha said, I have the Dharma gate of the treasure house of the true Dharma eye, the wonderful heart of Nirvana, the true form, which is no form. I now hand it on to Kashapa. This is the essence of our school. The transmission outside the teachings started with this. And so that, as Tori says, is what that means, right? When he held up the flower and Kashapa smiled in response, totally understanding it at an embodied level, that was this transmission. This transmission where nothing transmits. In the next few sections, Daibi in particular is going to talk a little bit about this. I'm actually going to talk about this, the Flower Sutra, that's called, quite a bit. But he'll talk about working with that as a koan in the Wuming Guan. That's one of the koans that you work with. And when you work with that koan, most koans, there's kind of they're either divided into parts, and then there's a bunch of what they call checking questions, which is to sort of plumb your depths, but they're basically sub-koans, more koans you have to do to get past them. And one of those koans is what is transmitted, right? You know, what does they mean? What is transmitted, right? And the Buddha, you have to understand what he meant holding up the flower, right? But not just in an intellectual sense, right? Like I could say in an intellectual way what that meant, right? And then you have to understand what Kashapa's smile meant, right? But what this is, just in the Rinzai lineage, what that is this is how Lin Chi put it, host meeting host, right? This is somebody presenting original nature. There's flower holding that up. This was a presentation of original nature. How exactly? You'll have to work on in the koan. Kashapa's smile, that was a response from original nature. Once again, exactly how that works, right? But the key thing is it works beyond words, beyond description, right? When you talk about that, in the Sanzen room, you have to express that yourself. Right? That's why there's not much I can say about it. But you can kind of, at an intellectual level be like, and that, you're even saying that, expressing it, that's an intellectual abstraction of that, a finger pointing at the moon, right? But the fact that Kashapa had awakened to his original nature, and the Buddha was, of course, awakened to the original nature, that's the transmission, right? The teacher doesn't make the student. You can't make the student awaken. If teachers had some way to make students awaken, we'd have a lot more awakened people. But the teacher constantly prods you, constantly pushes you, is never satisfied with where you're at, always pushing you deeper, always presenting a new device, right? That's another part of this lesson of this whole things there, right? When you work with a teacher,
They will present you like the medicine that you need at that time, right? The example I've given numerous times is Matsu presenting the mind as Buddha to one student, right? And then no mind, no Buddha to another student, right? So mind is Buddha, right, as the mind-only view, right? And that's where that student was at, right? That would be like Lin Chi saying when he takes away the man or the surroundings, right? In that case, he's taking away the surroundings, right? He's saying that everything you see is from mind, right? When he says no mind, no Buddha, in that case, he's taking away the man, right? Which is better translated as dharmas, right? He's taking away these notions that you have of reality, right? Of how things are, these truths that you think you've seen, right? That's the Madhyamaka perspective, no mind, no Buddha. No mind is the Yogacara perspective. But the final perspective, right? The Zen perspective, the Chan perspective, is holding up that flower, expressing Buddha nature directly, exposing it to them, and then you respond from Buddha nature. And only one person in that whole assembly responded. Only one person was ripe to that. That was the right thing for that one person, right? This is not one of the stories where the Buddha, the course of the discourse, awakened everybody in the audience, right? This is more of an example of how it typically is, right? The normal case where you work with a student long enough, and when they're ripe, maybe you can prod them with the right thing at the right time, right? Probably 9 times out of 10 or 99 times out of 100, that doesn't work. You think something's the right thing, but it doesn't work. But at that one right moment, you know, when the causes and conditions are ready, the student is at that place, you can hold up a flower and they'll see that for what it is. And that is going to be the thrust of these next few sections from Toray as he shifts from Indian Buddhism into the roots of Chan.